straight to the question. What was your main reason for deploying anachronism to make ancient Rome relevant to the reader, making history more accessible? Or were there other reasons you used it?
Well, it happened organically. So I didn't sit down and plan to use anachronisms. What happened was I started writing, well, just to say that the novel began life as a few poems that then became a novel, so it was never intended to be a novel.
Right.
And the first few poems that were just a few poems did not use anachronism. But then when I decided to think about it as a novel-length thing, somehow I got into a very playful spirit with it. And because it was set in ancient Roman London, and because I did study Latin for 5 years at school, at some point I must have got the idea, let me throw some Latin in. But of course, once you're throwing Latin into English, you know, playing around, well, what happened was I was then playing around with the Latin that I was using, because I was using some real Latin words, but also bastardizing Latin words. So I think that helped me become more playful in terms of the novel. I did want it to feel very immediate, very contemporary. I didn't want it to feel that this was an historical novel that was remote, distant, that people couldn't relate to. Mm. Or rather, I wanted them to believe in Zuleika almost as a contemporary figure. So I wanted them to think that this could be a young girl today, to make it as vivid as if she was a girl living in London today. And so the anachronism helps to do that because it plays around with the time of the novel. You think you're reading about ancient Rome, but you're constantly encountering references to our contemporary world. So while it's historical, it also feels very contemporary, which I hope makes it feel very relevant. So Zuleika, for example, is somebody living nearly 2,000 years ago, but actually the kind of life that she leads, in the sense of getting married at a very young age to this old bloke as she sees him, and having very restricted life, is relevant still today to people living in certain parts of the world. So hopefully people, through the anachronisms, can make those connections. It also allowed me to play around with what is usually regarded as, you know, the seat of Western civilization, the root of it. It's the Romans have been treated with a lot of reverence, and it was allowed me to subvert that and make humour of it, because I think the anachronisms they constantly disrupt your sense of the Romans having this revered civilization, because it's so playful.
Mm. Thank you. Great.
Welcome. So, Melvin, what's the next question?
Next, come on. So, Zuleika, because I grew up in London, and I totally, completely, when I read it, I thought, God, this could just be me. It's just amazing, but it totally worked. So I really enjoyed that, and it would be a totally different novel, and I think less of one without it. But do you think Zuleika's voice could have retained her modernity and that urban London edge? There's a lot of bastardized Latin sometimes goes into like Cockney rhyming. It's amazing what you've done. Without the anachronism, do you think that could have happened? Kept that urban edge?
Well, you know, the thing is, if you think about it in a very kind of sort of logical sense, she would have spoken Latin. So if I was really being true to history, I would have written a translation of Latin, really, wouldn't I?
Yeah, it's all anachronism, actually.
It is all, really, yeah. Because, and of course Latin, from what I remember, is quite a limited language. So I would have had they would have put a limit on what I was able to express with the language. So writing it in contemporary English, it's just how contemporary I make the English. So, for example, when I do use the slang, like what's up, you know, in it, things like that, which is very much of the very late 20th century, that just makes it more kind of, I don't know, I keep using the word contemporary. It just makes it more of the moment, because it is all contemporary. isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm. Yeah.
So, yeah, but what I could have done is I could have recreated a very literal translation of Roman London. I mean, I could have done that. Historically, I could have written Roman London as I imagined it was. But that would have restricted my imagination as a writer, my freedom. And the same way that in my book Blonde Roots, I've created this parallel universe. I didn't want to just write Roman London as it was, you know. So, to me, in a sense, that would be quite boring. Mm-hmm. Even so, we're always imagining the past. It's always a version of the past that we write about, you know, because we never really know what it was like. We don't really know what they felt, especially women in the Roman world. We don't really know, do we?
No. We don't have any of their voices.
No, yet they were human and as developed as we are, so we imagine they had a similar emotional range or same emotional range. Mm. So, yeah.
Question 3 is about sexuality. Venus.
Oh, yes.
Presented as a transvestite. Tranny Hades.
Great. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. I haven't read it for a while.
So, by layering... I'm still talking about anachronism. Layering modern sexual and gender identities on top of the ancient Roman ones. The ancient Roman ones are lost, although as we've just established, we lose them anyway, unless we're writing then in Latin for then. The benefit of this is because it strips away the alien.
Is what, sorry?
It strips away the alien. So by having anachronism, by having... Venus presented as a transvestite. Because if a Roman, an ancient Roman, read Venus, they might assume that Venus was a Canadus, which is a identity that no longer exists in our culture, but an identity that, unlike a eunuch, can no longer exist because we have no idea. So it would be very difficult to write about. And obviously, if you're writing something that you're trying to use terms that the audience is going to relate to instantly, rather than having to explain them to you. Terms to them. Did you ever consider representing the ancient Roman sexuality, or was this one of the things you considered irrelevant to a modern audience? Because there are some things in the book which are very realistic to Roman times based on what we know of Rome.
I mean, it was a while now that I did the research, because it was like 1999, 2000.
Yeah, no, I think some of the questions were unfair. I thought that
that's all right. But I do remember reading about women dressing up as men and men dressing up.
Yeah.
So I remember reading about this civilization, which, of course, I hadn't learned about when I was studying at school, where there was cross-dressing.
Yes.
So I think that's where... I mean, I can't remember this term, Canadus. So I think that's what I was playing with.
Yes, yeah.
And it's just also, I quite like camp characters, so it just gave me an opportunity to play around with that sort of person. So that's what that was about, really.
Yeah. Great, thank you.
Yeah.
This is a question from me, but actually I would have taken it out because you asked the previous one and covered it off. But I mentioned to you that I wrote a paper and I took some examples of your work.
Yes, yes.
At a classics conference.
Oh, yeah.
And the classicists were keen, and I couldn't answer this question. There are a few questions I couldn't answer. This amour, it was tattooed on the fingers of drunken machistas who waited outside bars and wolf whistled at cute young chicks while grabbing their dicks. Pursing their lips and gyrating their hips. Chicks. You mean women by that, don't you?
I do, yes.
Absolutely. The chicks was a term that was used in Latin, the Latin word for chicks, which I forget now, polyps or something, I can't remember, to refer to a young boy who was just ripe.
Oh, really?
So the classicists were wondering.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yes, I know. And I kind of thought... Probably not, because what she's trying to do is bring it into the now, and we wouldn't relate to that.
No.
So that's irrelevant in this novel. But they wanted to know anyway, because, you know...
That's really interesting. Yes, yes, no, I didn't know.
Yeah.
No, not at all, yeah.
Question 4. As you noted in your interview with Amy Ruston, racism is a... So you've thought about race. Racism is a legacy of slavery. My research leads me to believe that the Romans did not dehumanise colour people in the same way that the British did during the period of empire. I found racism in Roman literature towards colour as well as towards barbarian traits like long hair.
Is this you saying?
Yeah.
You found it?
I found in my research...
Have you?
...that there is racism towards skin colour, towards long hair of the barbarians, the trousers. I found this in some of the orators, some of the poets, and the laws as well make me wonder. But my Latin's not good enough. I've got a few questions around those. I'd never go into as much detail if I wasn't doing this. So the Latin writers do not suggest, though, that Africans were a lower breed of human, or not human at all, as some British anthropologists did in the 18th century. Mm. So I just wanted to, because I know that you have this interest in race, did you find anything to the contrary?
Well, I wasn't doing like deep research.
Yeah.
I was just doing sort of general research. But I couldn't find evidence of anti-black racism.
There's not that much. I just found
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
And it's kind of hard for us to conceive of that, isn't it? Because we're so used to it being, for the last 500 years, part of our thinking. So with Suleika, for example, I have got her being singled out because she's dark, but I never go so far, except with her sister-in-law. Is it sister-in-law?
Yes. Yes, it's Felix's.
Yes,
sister, yeah.
Yes. I never go so far as to sort of really expose any kind of racism, because I didn't think it existed. So she has, but then it's very interesting to think, well, she would have been so different to so many people, say in London. So what did they just think, that she was a freak? Did they just accept her as being, because I've visualised her as very, very dark skinned, because I didn't want people to think, oh yeah, black Roman girl, Cleopatra, sort of, what's her name?
Elizabeth Taylor.
I didn't want them to think of that exotic sort of Middle Eastern look.
Yeah.
I wanted them to see really, really dark skin, which is why I make such a point of it.
Yeah.
So like when she's going through the streets, they say, is our little aubergine ready? And she's kept waiting at the baths, but is that because she's a kid or because she's dark? So I didn't know quite how to play that. So it's interesting. So the sort of original conceit of the book was to say, well, look, black people were here in Britain nearly 2,000 years ago. But then it was not going to be a book about racism then, because I couldn't find it.
Well, I think the perspective is not about the colour of the skin so much, but that's the obvious thing to poke at.
Mm.
If you're juvenile, I don't think juvenile did do it, but it was one of the names of Marshall or someone.
Mm.
It was, they would, the Africans were chucked into the same lot as the barbarian. It was anyone who wasn't Roman.
Yes.
Patrician. It was more of an elitist class thing. And I thought, was it or wasn't it? It was difficult to tell from the... I should have written the example down, actually. But it wasn't in the same way as British...
As it is now.
...imperial,
yes.
But what came from the slavery. Mm. It was most of the slaves, all of the slaves in that period of British Empire were black.
In the British Empire? The first slaves were native, indigenous, Indian, and also Irish, believe it or not, very briefly, who didn't last long.
Right.
And then it was all Africans,
All Africans. Yeah. So the Roman slavery was their empire included countries where there were lots of different indigenous people.
Mm.
So they were just as racist towards the barbarian hordes of Germania and Britannia as they were towards... I don't think it was about the colour of skin. It was about them not being...
It would be an interesting
Roman book
for someone to write, wouldn't it, to look at that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that you'd have to go deeper to back up the hypothesis. But I just wanted to kind of... I wanted to see whether you'd noticed anything... Because there was this, I don't know if you're aware of it, there was this awful religious woman who came from, I can't remember where it was exactly in Africa now, someone wrote a paper on it a year ago, and her remains were yes. who were taken part, and they tried to establish that she was less than a human, not human. I can't remember her name. Do you know who I'm talking
about? Is
this about?
The archaeological find of a few years ago?
No. This was in 18-something, British anthropologist. Oh. It was just awful.
Oh, yeah.
But there's nothing like that in Roman.
No,
it's not. There's no dehumanisation to the extent that, you know.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. It was a very, very different type of empire, I think. Mm. I mean, there was slavery, but...
But you could also become Roman.
Yes, you could become
that's
Roman.
That's the other thing, wasn't it? You know, it doesn't matter where you're from, you could become.
Yeah, and it's great that you use Severus, because...
yeah.
You know, in this novel, so... okay, great. Good. Because my novel's based in Alexandria, so there's loads
yes.
of people from
yes.
Nubia, and, you know...
Yes.
It's a real, you know, hot city. So it's not like, you know, there are a lot more black people there, so... Not like... London. Right, fine. This is a more general about writing and process. You regularly enter the sphere of historical fiction. Is there anything you did differently or experienced differently when setting a story in an ancient culture?
So, say that again?
So, you use history a lot.
Yes.
But it's kind of newer to us. So, when you went back into ancient history, was there anything that you experienced differently walking around in a London that was so, so different? I mean, I know that I experienced London when I read your book. I first read it when it first came out, in a way that I had never... It gave me a different layer, and that exists for me. It has existed ever since, this layer of London with the jungle and Bayswater and... you know, it added that layer, and then Salika, this kind of very modern, urban, edgy.
So you're saying, has it changed how I experienced the city?
Yeah.
Definitely when I was writing it. I mean, I love that though. I love that process of immersion. And I remember walking around the old, you know, the city, as in the capital city, you know, with the capital C, the financial square mile. I remember walking around there, so I had a map, still got it, of the Roman city within the walls, and it's transposed onto the modern city. So I could walk around the city, which of course is deserted at night, at the weekends, and I think a couple of Sundays I went walking, and I worked out where things would have been, where the river, Watling River, I think, which is now Watling Court, and where the Thames would have begun, because the Thames was, is it further back or, no, it's narrower. And it was, and like the Museum of London's got the London Wall, and they've actually got a remnant of the Roman Wall there. So it was such fun to imagine how it would have been. I mean, that's for me the magic of, part of the magic of writing is to just recreate something in your head. So it was quite deep, I think, with that book, because it was this city, it was one character, it was one place, one time, very limited space to recreate it. And they had in the Museum of London, you know, I think I said the other day, I think they've still got it, they've recreated Roman rooms. And there was a time, I think it might have gone now, where you walked past a certain part of the Roman exhibitions, and you'd hear somebody say something in Latin. And it was always, it's like, something Martina. And it was like, you know, but I was also craving to know more. If you asked me if I could time travel, it would be, probably number one would be Roman London. So it was frustration that I'll never really know what it was like. And then excitement that I could create the world as I liked it. Because, of course, having the freedom to play around with it meant that I could do anything, of course, because when you are an historian, you have to, you know, facts, and I didn't have to do that. And just imagining how sophisticated it was, you know, to think that there had been this 400-year period where that city over there was so sophisticated, you know, and the baths and the central heating and all that, and then it all went. So, it was great. It was, so you're reminding me, because I haven't really talked about it, since I did the research, really. And of course, I wasn't really au fait with the internet then.
Yeah.
So now research is so easy. So I used loads of books. I had about 40 books, and I just got rid of most of them. And becoming someone else, so becoming my protagonist, which is what, especially when it's a first person. Yeah, because you write first person, it is like a sort of, you do become a ventriloquist in a way. And it's hard not to be affected by your character, especially if you like your character. Well, you don't have to like the character. So it's being her and then just trying to recreate this world that she might have lived in. So they also, at the Museum of London, recreated some Roman streets, or a Roman street. I don't know if you ever knew about that.
No.
So they had a temporary exhibition, you know, one of their sort of exhibitions that only last a while. And they recreated, I think it was a Roman street, but I think it was maybe after The Empress Maid is published, and it was, you'd walk along the street, and then you go into people's houses. And it was a complete immersion experience. The houses would have ceilings and everything. It was amazing.
That is so brilliant.
You're walking along a dirt ground and in these kind of mud houses and, you know, a toilet in the middle, the corner of the room and so on.
Did you go to Pompeii when you were
I went to Pompeii several years after I wrote the book.
Right.
Because when I was at school, there was a school trip and I couldn't afford it. My parents couldn't afford it. And then I did go there eventually. Have you been?
I'm going in September.
Oh, I did go there and I went because I had a gig nearby. And I thought, right, I'm going to Pompeii. And it was a time of year when there was nobody there. It was wonderful. And it wasn't too hot. It's amazing. I mean, you could spend all day there and not see everything. It is the most incredible. I was like, oh, wow. And you just see these fossilised bodies where they, you know, when they were burnt alive. And just, yeah. I also went to Libya, to Leptis Magna.
Oh, wow.
And that was, again, several years after the book was published. And I had a gig in Libya running British Council workshops. And we went to, they took us to Leptis Magna, which is a huge, massive ruin. And because Libya is what it is, especially then, it's probably even worse now, it was a ruin. It's like there was, the archaeologists had excavated it, but they hadn't done anything to it. So there was no kind of recreation of anything. And there was nobody there. So there was myself and another writer and our guide just wandering around these ruins. Yes.
Oh, wow.
But it was, again, it was after, several years after. And because you couldn't get into Libya anyway. Even if I wanted to go there, you'd need a visa. And I only went because it was British Council and so on. So, Pompeii. Whoa. Amazing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Go early in the morning and, you know,
take
sandwiches and just...
last question.
Oh, okay.
So I said here, in a sense, all, but actually not in a sense, actually all historical novels are anachronistic. Is it the impression of whether it is realistic to the reader? It is the impression of whether it is realistic to the reader.
Come on, Melbourne, you can do better than this.
In the reader's mind, is it anachronistic or not? So a novel, even if Hilary Mantel, for example, decides to write in a Roman novel, she probably wants to be as close to the history as she possibly could.
Yeah, I imagine. Yeah.
It would still be anachronistic, but whether it feels that way to the reader, that's important.
Yes, whether they buy into it or not.
Exactly. So, in your novel, we know up front, from the beginning, this is anachronistic. So, everything you say, if you don't know the history, everything that's been said in the novel, you don't know whether it's real or not. But it doesn't matter, because that's, you know, the effect is that you're brought really close to it. In the novel I'm currently writing, it's just a question about I'm asking for your advice in the process. In the novel I'm currently writing, what I'm doing is I'm wanting to pull back the layer of our sexuality and show what it was like to live within the Roman mindset, so the Roman schema. And sometimes it's shown, so that Rome, the HBO BBC series, I don't know if you saw it,
A drama?
Yeah.
Was it a really long, went over?
It went on and seen.
I think
season.
I did watch some of it, yeah,
yeah,
I think
went
so.
Yeah, for a while. They were aiming at realism. And they did show some of the sexuality. So they showed, as you've done, you know, girl on girl and boys and, you know, different things. But they didn't explain the mindset. So they didn't explain that the paradigm was not about whether you're gay or straight, which Charles is, but it's about active and passive. And because that's not explained, you just see it through your lens, your modern lens.
Is that what that, is that how they saw it then?
That's how they saw it, yeah.
So it was either active or passive? You couldn't both be passive or both active?
That's a really good question.
Although if you're both passive, nothing much is going to happen,
but
really.
Not much would happen. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the closest way to describe it is through ours, which works really well in yours, and we're again with the class system, and I was saying, you know, this is a very anachronistic novel, but actually, you've probably got closer to ancient Roman sexuality than anyone else, because you've got all that S&M in there, and...
Yes.
And that's very close to the whole active and passive.
Yeah, definitely,
paradigm.
Definitely, yeah.
I'm aiming to establish realism, which is a stupid thing to do considering I'm not a historian, but anyway, that's where I'm going with it at the moment. And then, because the reader thinks they are in a realistic, that yes, this is Rome, this person is writing it as Rome was, that they will have those lenses stripped off, and they will be able to put down their modern lenses and experience ancient Roman sexuality as it was then through their eyes, and see the fallacy of that sexuality is social experience.
It is, but
it's a construct.
I can see. I mean, it's such controversial territory, isn't it? Because, for example, when boys and girls were married off young, weren't they? So,
yeah.
But they were willing partners. The boys, because it was part of the society.
Yeah.
But then that becomes an argument for what we call paedophiles today, doesn't it? So it's really kind of risky territory.
Yeah, it's very risky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hence, I think probably Stephen's comment about you're not going to get that published in America.
Well, I mean, Americans, there are all sorts of publishers in America.
Yeah.
I mean. But,
But I think the question is more about process, because I'm writing it anyway. This is what I'm writing.
Yes.
This is what the voice started talking to me, this older man in 2004, I've gone where he's taken me. I didn't say I'm going to write it. I didn't know about it then. It didn't appear to me until I was doing research.
Do you have first-person accounts? Have you read first-person accounts of men and boys talking about relationships and like men talking about their past sexual lives as children, essentially?
In ancient Roman
yes.
ones? There are quite a few of the older man perspective.
Okay.
But there are, and some of it in fiction, you know, drama and poetry. There are none, there's one actually, but there were none until not so long ago, till our lifetime, of the boy's perspective. And the only one that we have is Marcus Aurelius. They discovered the Fronto letters, and Fronto is a great orator in the era of Cicero. And Cicero had, and all the other writers, who I can't remember the names, but it's wonderful, there's no one like Fronto, who's better, Fronto or Cicero, but we have none of Fronto's stuff. And then his letters were discovered about 40 years ago or so.
Where were they discovered?
They were discovered, and I think in the Vatican, because of course the church went in, destroyed the libraries, but a lot of them were scholars, so I imagine what happened, possibly, is that they couldn't bear to destroy all of these amazing works, and so they took them away. The name of the rose was about this, is that book about laughter, that I can't remember the name, is it Aristophanes or someone, and it was all about hiding those books. Did you ever see the film?
No.
It was a Berto Eco novel. And this amazing library inside this, in Renaissance Italy, and there was this amazing library, and no one was allowed to see any of these books, and they put poison on the pages of these particular books to stop the monks from seeing them. And the whole thing was about not seeing these ancient classical books because they had all this sex in them and all this, you know, laughter and humour and non-Christian stuff. And but they couldn't destroy them because they're just amazing books. And so what was your question again? Sorry.
Children's accounts.
Yes.
Oh, and you said that there was this example.
Yeah. I'm doing the interview, not you. I think it was either the Vatican Library or another library, but there's probably loads and loads of these documents still in libraries, Catholic libraries around the world, probably mostly in Rome, obviously, where someone has saved these books.
So he talks about his...
Marcus Aurelius, his letters back and forth between the two of them. And a lot of scholars would say they're not love letters and have just poo-pooed it. And they say it was like rubbish and no one really heard Fonto's name ever again. But actually, so it's between the emperor and his mentor. And I only found out about these at that conference. I didn't know about them. I'd been searching for a first-person voice of the boy. He was 17 at the time he wrote them, so he was at the upper end of what they would consider pedophilia. He could start as soon as the balls drop, essentially. So that's different age, different voice. And that's the only first-person voice. And there is a question as to whether they're love letters or not, but there is no other first-person voice.
No.
And most of the humour in Marshall and Juvenile is all from the older man's perspective and mocking the old man or exalting the relationship. Marguerite Yourcenar wrote memoirs, Hadrian had this relationship.
Yes, I think I mentioned it. I think I mentioned it.
You mentioned it, yeah.
Antonio?
Antinus, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Interesting. Very
but that's
interesting.
Again from the older man's perspective, not obviously that's contemporary, but old-ish. So the answer is yes, from the older man, but we don't have that person voice, or possibly Marcus Aurelius is the only one we have.
Great. So where are you with the novel?
I've got a first draft. It's very first draft, so I won't be showing it to anyone this time. some bits are more edited than others. So I'm giving up work at the end of September to spend 12 months finishing it and finishing the Pada.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah, good.
Yeah. Did you see any difficulties I might have other than the people might be able to publish that?
It depends on how much of it is in the novel, you know. If it's like a chapter, you take that chapter out, you know. I know if it's a choice between getting the novel published and taking that chapter out, or not getting the novel published and keeping it in, then it's a no-brainer, really, isn't it? Because you want it published. Difficulties. In what sense? Just the story?
As trying to whip off those rose-tinted those glasses, our filters of our sexual identity, which is obviously very different. And because anachronism is great, and I thought about using it, and it kind of came out to use it, probably because I didn't use it so much, but that doesn't serve the purpose that I'm trying to
do. Because then it
feels very much on, which
takes
the alien out of it, which is great. You know, great effect, but I'm trying to bring the alien in.
Put the alien back in. I can't, you know, you just have to, you know, you have to convince the reader that this, of what you're doing, that's the thing. It's about enrolling the reader in your story, and then like you said with The Emperor's Babe, people decide, okay, I'm going to go with this. Because the character kind of grabs you initially. It's the character's voice.
Yeah.
And then you just take them on this journey. And, you know, hopefully they stay with you. And you do that through the characterization, through the voice, through the quality of the drama that you're creating, through the authentic detail. Because, I mean, even though I play with anachronism, it has a lot of authentic detail in it.